guys.
I ran out of time and then I forgot. But, but it was cool. It's funny because. Okay, it is 7:01 and I'm going to call this meeting to order. Will everyone rise with me to say the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. So, Cheryl, will you do the roll call for us, please?
Present.
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 Okay, we have heard from both of those, and we are asking, or I'm asking, if someone will excuse both Councilwoman Dunlea and Councilwoman Kelly.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Approval of the agenda, and I want to make note that on the new agenda that we have here, there was one that was sent out late. Under consent agenda, we have item 8, which happens to deal with the vending machine for the fire department. So just to make note that that is there when we're looking at the whole agenda. So I'm looking for an approval.
Madam Mayor, I move to approve the agenda.
Okay. Do I have a second? Any discussion? All right. I have a move by Councilman Couch and seconded by Councilman Owen. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Looking at the consent agenda again, this would be items 1 through 8. Looking for a motion.
Madam Mayor, I make a motion to approve the consent agenda items 1 through 8.
Second.
Okay. I have a motion by Councilwoman Kinzer and seconded by Councilwoman Cornegay. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, so we have tonight a special guest. Dana Brothers of Hospice is going to talk with us about November being palliative care, correct? Yes, all right.
Good evening, and I feel kind of badly. I'm going to maybe stand sideways so I can get all of you guys. Thank you for having me, Madam Mayor.
Yes.
I came today to talk to the city about November being National Hospice and Palliative Care Month. We provide service to all of the residents in Skagit County, in Cedro Woolley, Mount Vernon, Concrete. We go all the way out to the islands, the San Juan Islands. We provide service to patients in Snohomish County and in Island County. Every year, we provide services to about 950 people in the last stages of their life. And one of the reasons I came today was to talk to you a little bit about the myths and realities with hospice. Hospice is scary for many people. They are afraid to start a conversation. And so at the back of the room, I brought a few tools. I'd like to offer them to you. And if I have my business card, if you run out of them and you'd like some more, please just give me a call or email me and I'll give them to you. This is probably one of the best tools that anyone could ever have. This is about starting a conversation when you're nearing the end of your life, what do you want to have happen? Because as far as we know, no one gets out of this life alive, right? We're all going to die. And wouldn't it be great to be educated about it, to have a plan about it, and to know that the people who love you have your documented wishes written down? So that's what the five wishes is about. It's about finding out who's going to speak for you if you can't speak for yourself, and who's going to be around you at the end of your life. What are the things you want or don't want? And we have found that when people have a map to follow, like these five wishes, and someone they love is at the end of their life, if they're able to go to that document and say, well, Mom said she wants to make sure the window's open. She wants to make sure she has Grandma's quilt on the bed. She wants to make sure that Petey, her cat, is in the room. If you, as an adult child, are able to do that for your mother, you feel like you've been able to honor her wishes. And then when she does die, that grieving process is less painful and less lengthy because there's not a feeling of guilt. There's not a feeling of, what more could I have done? Because her wishes were documented and you followed them. So I highly, highly recommend, if you have not filled out one of these, please do. Please take one. And if you want some more information on how to start that conversation, our contact information is on here, and I would be more than happy to meet with you and any of your friends or family. So the other thing I wanted to bring and talk about is the myths that we have with hospice. Hospice is often feared as the last place. It's the place I'm going to go to die. Once I go on hospice, I'm giving up. And that couldn't be further from the truth. Hospice is a philosophy of care to provide compassion and dignity for every moment of life. Our job, it's the one field in medicine where we get to go to a patient and say, what would you like? When you go to the doctor says, you have this illness, you have this disease, you have this injury, this is how I'm going to treat it, this is the medicine you're going to take. When you go on hospice, the doctor says, what would you like? How would you like to be treated? What kind of medication do you want to take or not take? Would you like to have all of your pain taken away, or do you want to be alert and awake? You get to decide, and we do what you tell us to do. So it's the one time when you're making all the decisions and you're in charge of your care plan. Once you start on hospice, you have the opportunity to go off. If you find there's some treatment that you haven't tried, you find out about and you'd like to try it, you're welcome to go off of hospice, try that treatment, and then if it doesn't work, you can come back on as long as you meet the qualifications. So it's not the end of the line. It doesn't mean you're going to die immediately. It's all about providing you the best quality care for every moment of life. A couple other things that people feel are the truth with hospice is that it's really hard to get on hospice and that you have to have a doctor sign an order. And that's not actually the case with Hospice of the Northwest. Anyone can refer anyone to hospice. All we need is their name and their date of birth and their primary care physician. The one thing you can't do is say, hey, my name's Jim, and my neighbor's not looking good. I think it's time for hospice. You can't do that. You have to get consent from the patient. So if you're thinking, gosh, my dad's driving me nuts, let's get him on hospice. Can't do that. You got to make sure your dad's willing to go on the program. So we address physical pain, because often when people die, they have an illness, a disease that can cause pain. But we also address spiritual and psychosocial pain. Sometimes people don't have any pain in their body from their disease, but they have existential pain because they're leaving this life. They're leaving their family. They're leaving their friends. They're leaving their children and grandchildren, and they don't know how to cope. So we have a whole team of people. We have a medical director, we have RNs, we have social workers, spiritual counselors, volunteers, and all of these people form this plan that support the patient and their loved ones. So know that hospice is not something that signs your death sentence. Hospice is that continuation of care when the doctor tells you, there's nothing more I can do. We're there to help you. So please pick up a packet, make sure you get your five wishes, and I would love to be able to talk to you, your group, your family, individually about how you can be prepared and know what to expect when it's the end of your life. And Madam Mayor, you have a proclamation you are going to read for us?
I do. Whereas all people are encouraged to learn about options for care, options like hospice and palliative care, before they are confronted with the healthcare crisis, and to share such wishes through the appropriate advanced care planning activities, whereas hospice and palliative care empower people to live as fully as possible, surrounded and supported by family and loved ones, despite serious and life-limiting illness. Whereas hospice and palliative care brings patients and family caregivers to the highest quality care delivered by an interdisciplinary team of skilled professionals that include physicians, nurses, social workers, therapists, counselors, health aides, spiritual care providers, and those who make the wishes of each patient and family a priority. Whereas advanced care planning involves making decisions about the health care an individual would want to receive if he and she were facing a serious or life-limiting illness, or if they were unable to speak for themselves. Whereas through pain management and symptom control, caregiver training and assistance, and emotional and spiritual support, allowing patients to live fully up to the final moments, surrounded and supported by the faces of loved ones, friends, and committed caregivers, hospice and palliative care focus on quality of living. Whereas each year, hospice saves Medicare more than $2 billion by providing solutions for physicians, care to patients, and comfort to families anywhere at any time. Whereas every year, more than 1.65 million Americans living with life-limiting illness and their families received care from the nation's hospice programs in communities throughout the United States. Whereas more than 430,000 trained volunteers contribute 19 million hours of service to hospice program annually. Whereas hospice and palliative care providers encourage all people to learn more about options of care and to share their wishes with family, loved ones, and their health care providers. Now and therefore, let it be resolved that I, Julia Johnson, Mayor by virtue of the authority vested in me in Cedra Woolley, Skagit County, Washington, do hereby proclaim November 2018 as National Hospice and Palliative Care Month, and encourage citizens to increase their understanding and awareness of care at the end of life and to observe this month with appropriate activities and programs. All right. Thank you, Dana, very much for coming. Mm-hmm. It's a very, as you said, a very difficult topic, but thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and we will move into staff reports. Good evening, Paul. How are you?
Doing just fine. So I've got a couple things to share for the chief. We just completed our business audit through Washington State Patrol and passed. We got an above average score, which the front office is very proud of. We have the Halloween parade coming up on Halloween at 4:30. I'd like to invite any of the city council members who would be able to come down and assist us with handing out the stickers and candy. Because of staffing, we're not going to be able to have our normal spot at the gazebo. And so we've got, I think, one officer right now who's coming in to do it with his family, but we don't have anybody else. So anyone who could come, the mayor agreed to come. I saw it in an email earlier today, so anyone who would join us, we'd greatly appreciate it. Another thing of note, we've been having a bunch of problems downtown at the bars. We're coming up to one of our busiest bar nights coming up this Friday, Saturday. And we're working pretty close with liquor control to have a bunch of them down there, hopefully for some pretty good enforcement. We've had a couple incidents of enforcement here recently that have worked out pretty well for us. Mm. That's all I got. Mm.
That was a lot. Thank you. Chief.
Mr. Mayor, I want to apologize to the council. I got this to you late, these memorandums. I was hoping to get them into the pack, but we just didn't get time to do them. But we do have 7 of 8 paramedics conditional offers out. We're just waiting to hear their finals on their medical and their psychological testing. So we were real excited. They were actually in today and visited with us and got sized for uniforms and everything. So we're pretty sure they're going to pass those last hurdles. We did have our WSRB rating. We've got it on the table here for you. We are still considered a class 5, so we're right in the mid-range. If you'd like to look at the down and dirty, the book's about so thick, I'd be happy to have you come in and we can go through it with you. Some of the things that they gigged us on was they said we didn't have a training tower for our ladder truck, and we said, well, it's right there. And they said, no, that's a dual use, that's a hose tower, so that doesn't count. So there's lots of little things with Survey and Rating Bureau that we didn't agree with, but we're happy that we stayed the same, that we didn't go down any. The building status out here, I don't know if Nathan's going to speak on it, but these guys have been doing an amazing job. I don't know if you've had a chance, you know, to come by during the daytime and take a look at what they've done out there. They've almost got that thing completely dried in. I'll give Kevin heck for missing those last few boards tomorrow, but it's almost completely dried in. So now we're going tomorrow. Hopefully we'll get the subcontractors in and start looking at their bids so we can get to the next phase of that. We're going to make a heck of a good stab at it for getting those new medics quarters by the first of the year, but we may get held up because of subcontractors, in which case we'll punt and we'll get rooms for them. We did have a Skagit County DEM Advisory Board meeting today. We were over there for a couple hours, and he would like to come over and address the council, and I'll get with Aaron and the mayor. He'd like to do like a short 15-minute presentation, and I realize that council meetings between now and the end of the year are pretty well booked, so I told him I would get back with him with a date for that. But he'd just like to come over and talk about what's going on with DEM and what they're looking at for the future. So I have him.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Coleman?
Thank you very much. So the planning department's slowly working through our mountain of projects, land use projects. You've probably seen on the notice board that it's all full up with notices of applications and SEPA determinations and public notice periods. So we're getting through that. The Planning Commission will be again working on the urban village mixed use regulations that City Council gave some input on back in September at the work session. And the Planning Commission is also working on a request from a private landowner or developer who's asked for a code change to the zoning code. And so if the Planning Commission will be holding a public hearing on that change to zoning just in the R15 zone. It's a fairly minor, hopefully, request. And if the Planning Commission makes a recommendation, it'll be coming to the City Council probably based on how busy the council agendas are going to be for the next few months, and may not make it on until the January agenda. We also received the final paperwork necessary to move forward with the annexation petition request. So those applicants will now be moving on to the next step in the process. So that is still moving along. It's not quite ready for council yet. And I'll keep you informed. That's all I've had.
All right, thank you. Mr. Freiberger.
Thank you, Mayor. Well, I'm glad to report that the Fruitdale project was paved on the 12th and opened to traffic beginning of last week. And so that's working well. Traffic's slowly picking up on the route there. We still have a few things to finish yet, mostly the striping, which has to wait for 21 days after the pavement. So that about the second, third week of November, that'll be done, weather permitting. The Swiss Center sign is scheduled. The foundation will be poured on Monday and or Friday, excuse me, and put up after the cure time, and then some landscaping around that. So we're getting very close on that project. We'll be closing that out in November. The State Street Overlay Project, I'm glad to report that the railroad tracks are gone on State. They were removed on Monday and took the railroad two excavators and all day to do that. In addition to the two tracks that were visible, there were two other lines that the rails had been removed, but the ties were still in place. So it was quite an operation to get that removed. They are going to come back in about 2 weeks and remove the crossing at Ferry Street. And we're going to lower that. We probably won't get much more than a temporary patch this year due to the time of year and my short crew. But we'll lower that about a foot and a half next year and take about half of the hump off when we do the projects next season. SRV is doing that project and expecting to do the overlay work in about 2 weeks. We're doing the ramps that had to be upgraded as a part of that, and they're working right along on that right now, and the other repairs that need to happen. SRV is also doing the Bennett-Nelson-Beatty sewer project. They should have finished with, they had finished Beatty already, West Bennett already. They should have finished Beatty today, and they'll start on West Nelson next week. Figure another week they'll have the pipe in and be ready to start their paving operation. So those are moving along well. The sidewalk from Township to Fruitdale on the north side of 20 is basically complete. We left out a little gap, if you're wondering about it, where Doc Campbell's roadway is going in for his commercial development. He wanted us to leave that section out, and he's going to pour that himself sometime in the next month. But we've put in some temporary gravel there, and it's totally usable, and people are walking it and using bikes on it. So. They're also using the route up to Northern States. We're seeing bicycles and pedestrians regularly using those things. So it's a good thing to see. Beyond that, we advertised for bid for the library preload project and also for the wastewater treatment plant improvements project we've been talking about. We have pre-bid meetings on the 1st, and then those close on the 15th. So you'll see those if we get good bids on the 24th for award, and those projects will be done over the course of this winter. On the preload, that worked out to about 7,500 tons of material that we have to put on the site. About half of that will remain a structural fill for the new building. And the rest of it we'll haul off, and we'll use that on one of two city projects that we have planned, so it won't be lost at all. Then on your dais tonight, there's a late materials packet I want to bring to your attention. Debbie Allen told me earlier today they're having a problem with the Jones Road pump station. We had our on-call electrical contractor come out to try to diagnose that. They thought we had a bad pump. We took that out, had it rewired. Turned out the pump wasn't bad. Then they thought it was a bad soft start module. Turned out, and they did put that in, and it did work for about 2 weeks, and now it's out again. We're concerned that we don't have the level of expertise with the electricians that we've been using to properly diagnose that. And this has gotten to the emergency point for us because we're operating on one pump, and that's not a good situation to be in with those stations. So we're proposing to hire Ackerman Electric. They're a local firm out of Mount Vernon who has worked for us in the past. They haven't been applying for our on-call operations over the years, but they are expert in diagnosing and working on the kind of equipment we have here, and we're proposing to do an emergency contract with them to diagnose and repair that pump station. And so I've explained that further in the memo, but that's the long and the short of it. We have the ability to declare an emergency on certain conditions, and we feel that this fits in that category, and I am recommending tonight if you would move to award this contract to Ackerman, we'll move forward with that and get that pump station back into full operation. So,
all right, thank you. Is the council willing to move forward on this? Have you had a chance to read through it?
Madam Mayor, I read it and I move to declare an emergency and authorize City Supervisor Aaron Berg signing the attached emergency electrical repair contract with Ackerman Electric Company of Mount Vernon in the amount not to exceed $10,000.
All right. So I have a motion by Councilman Couch, seconded by Councilman Owen. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. Mr. Berg?
I guess the only thing I'd mention for you tonight is fencing's up around the library, project site location. Fire department had some wonderful training there this week. So if you notice missing windows or holes in walls or roofs, those are not vandals. They're fully trained firefighters, and Dean's got the saw blade bill to prove it. Nathan's going to be mobilizing a crew, what, Friday? That'll be tomorrow. So you'll start to see a mini in there pulling some of the metal off for recycling, and then next week the big equipment will come in for the major demolition work. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Merriman.
Thank you, Mayor. From the Finance Department, the world's been about the budget the last few weeks, and our main goal right now is by November 1st to have a balanced preliminary budget to the mayor. And we're just a couple of conversations and a couple of numbers away from that, so we're getting very close. One thing I wanted to do was give a shout out to a couple of the staff in finance, one Christine and the other Amanda. They've been working hard on a project we've been doing. One of our goals is to get information out to the public more and make some of our documents more accessible. On our website, there's a link to go to ordinances and resolutions. You used to be able to go and click there and you would see a list of the ordinance or resolution. It would tell you the number. Then you could call City Hall to get a copy of it. When you look at it now, you can actually click on it and the ordinance and resolution will pop up for you and you can print it off or save it to your computer. So it makes it a lot quicker for people who are interested in finding out information. We have more documents coming that we'd like to do that. We've finally got the infrastructure set up and we've got that project rolling ahead. So that's what I have for tonight.
That's fantastic. Thank you. Councilman Couch.
Madam Mayor, nothing to report.
All right. Councilman Owen.
I have a couple of things. Today we had the honor of having Mr. Dahlstedt down for lunch at the Senior Center. And I thought he'd done a real good job. He went to each table and spent a considerable amount of time talking to each group of people, and they appreciated that. next week, Ron Whedon and Lisa Janicki are coming, so if any of you people want to come down and meet them and visit and ask questions, well, you're certainly welcome. Also, the ladies at the Senior Center asked me to pass the word here. This one lady has got a bow door, and she drew a scene on the end of it, and it's up for sale, and the proceeds from that go to the senior services. So if you're up the creek without a paddle, just come on down. We'll sell you one. that's about all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilwoman Cornegay?
I just wanted to bring up that this coming Friday, Plastics Ocean will be playing at the library. I think it's at 6. I think it's at 6. So anyway, there's that. And then I wanted to ask again about the that intersection McGargle and Highway 9 where those trees are, actually it's getting so bad because of the fog and everything. And I'm just kind of concerned for some of the school kids that are crossing over right there. I mean, I don't know if there's a plan in place yet, but that whole intersection, especially that going east on McGargle coming from John Liner, that left side is really, the north side of that is with those trees. And then I noticed even going west, sometimes it's kind of, you have to really pull out into that intersection in order to see if there, you know, and then the kids can't use the crosswalk if you're too far out there.
Yeah, the south east corner is trimmed back all the way to the right-of-way line. Any farther, it would have to be on the private property there. We did look at that. Nathan had taken care of that some time ago. Are you also talking about the southwest side? Or the northwest side where I think there's some arborvitaes there.
The northwest is the worst, I think.
That's the worst side?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I didn't actually look at that. I thought you were talking about the other side. We'll take a look at that as well. Those trees are on private property as well. I know that because we had to buy a little corner when we did the project some years ago. so it makes it sort of difficult. But we'll look in and see if there's anything.
Well, maybe we could do something like, think about doing something with the crosswalk, like maybe some extra reflectors or a flashing light or something.
Yeah, we do have planned to put a flashing signal similar to the one that is at the Ford crossing. That's been on our twice delayed now ramp and sidewalk upgrade project, so that is planned. We'll get that in next summer. That'll help. Of course, they run crossing guards there during the start and stop times at school, which mm-hmm. which really helps, and still is going to be necessary after this is all done.
Yeah, because you know she can only do so much. There's really just one person there, and there's a lot going on with the trucks coming down the hill and everything. I'm just really concerned for the kids.
Okay, well, Aaron just mentioned to me that we can do a code enforcement on those corners, so we'll go ahead and initiate that and see if we can get those cleaned up.
Thank you.
That's it. All right, thank you. Councilwoman Kinzer.
Speaking of brush on corners, I want to say thank you to Nathan and your crew for taking care of the brush on the corner of Wally and Talcott. Much, much better we can actually see now, so thank you.
All right. All right. Councilman DeYoung.
Hello, everyone over there. wanted to say thank you to law enforcement for the invitation and the ride-along with code enforcement and animal control. That was a very educational ride. Nice new shiny truck with the lift gate. And I heard a report earlier about the Department of Emergency Management, or DEM. I'm sure it'll come in handy if we need some of that. If you want to learn about your neighborhood, take a ride with code enforcement. Then also, I was wondering about the radar reader that you had out on Railroad Avenue. It has an IP address, and if we could get a scattergraph of frequency, intensity, and duration of speeding through there. Sat out there with a neighbor out on Railroad Bennett, and it looks like people like to head east on Jameson, crack the corner onto Railroad, and head straight out of town. And it's a beautiful road. Thank you, Mark, for that. But we have neighbors out there that are concerned, and I know you have 42 spots around the city with those concerns, but. If the data supports emphasis patrol, that would be great. I have been spending some time out there on Railroad Avenue and have direct observations of what the neighbors are talking about. And also, you do have the support of the neighbors if you need to borrow driveways to put in the trailer. So that, I want to report that back to you. Then, let's see, Mark. On the State Street project, I'm wondering if we could get some safety separation as pedestrians have to get into the road to use those crosswalks on State Street that are being updated with the ADA ramps. You do have to go out in the street and be much closer to the motor vehicles. I was wondering, what your plan was on that, maybe put out some pylons. To show some separation, give some safety to vulnerable users that are still walking to the Central Business District. Thank you for looking into that. And then I've had the great opportunity to work multiple times with the Planning Department. We have neighbors discussing things about the 717 Township project. I really want to thank John and the department for being very receptive to comments and working through some of the issues. I know that there's some technical jargon that may have been misinterpreted, but it sounds like the neighbors are being heard. So thank you for that and continuing to work with that. And I'm looking forward to some new neighbors there. I have, as council has been receiving as well, received a petition and phone calls and emails regarding the 200 block of North Reed Street. John, do we have, I didn't see it in our packet, a plan to put a park there? Do we have a plan for it to be developed? I don't have that information, don't see it in the packet, but that's what neighbors are talking about, and...
Well, Mr. DeYoung, actually...
I'm sorry.
Well, actually,
I just have a question about it. Thank you.
We haven't decided yet what we're going to do regarding that. We still... That was something that we were looking at with Habitat for Humanity. So we haven't... The council still has to make a decision regarding that and have discussion
okay,
regarding
so
that.
So from the contact that I've been receiving from Madam Mayor, from our neighbors, I see one in the audience tonight that I'm speculating that there will be public comment. This isn't an either-or situation between a development versus a park or a park versus a development. There are no plans in effect. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
All right. So I just have words of thanks. I too, had the opportunity to ride with Officer Carr. That was a great experience. It was a lot of fun, and I would encourage the council. She's put that invitation out to you. And if you have time, do make the time to do that. It was very educational. And also to Councilman Owen for the lunch invitation. I appreciated it. My mother and I had a very nice visit with you and with Commissioner Dahlstadt, so thank you. And then to the citizens of Cedar Woolley, I want to extend our thanks for your patience as we've been working on State Street. I know that it's sometimes it's a mystery how to get in and out of town. I've found myself there myself, but you've been very patient, and I just want to extend that thanks while we do the much-needed work. So with that, I am going to open public comment. It is 7:36, and if you'd like to come forward and give comment, I ask that you give your name and your street address, and keep it to approximately 3 minutes, if possible.
I'll try. My name is Marlon Miller. I live at 713 Brickyard Boulevard here in Cedar Woolley. Madam Mayor and City Council members, thank you for the opportunity to come and share. We appreciate your services. You probably don't get told that too often, but we do appreciate you. I'm here this evening concerning, the proposed city park at 205 North Reed Street. And I'm urging you to move forward with this project. The location is perfect for a park with a number of housing units around there. Some of the facts that you're probably aware of, but I'll share with you. I'm president of North Community and Brickyard Creek Community Association. We have 80 homes in our association. And then just down the street from us, Valley View Trailer Park, 700 North Reed, has 104 units. Donna Skaggs, the manager, is in favor of you moving forward with the project. Kids are playing in the streets and in their parking lots. This will help solve the problem if we move forward with this. Next to that is Skagit Valley View Park, 600 North Reed, 50 units. Mark is the manager, and he is in favor of the city moving ahead with this project. Same problems, kids playing in their parking lots. Then I went over and visited Woodlands Apartments on North Murdoch. They have 71 units, then Murdoch Village has 26 units. Same problems. Kelsey Frederick is the manager, and she's in favor of this project moving forward. I didn't get to see the manager at Logan Apartments, but there's 47 units there. And I can attest that we do need a park, because our backyard is up to there, and their parking lot is right to our backyard, and I'm constantly throwing soccer balls back, coming over the fence. So anyway, totaling the homes and units comes to 378. I didn't get over to Central Avenue, which would back the park on the other side. More homes there. I would guess this park at 205 North Reed could easily be looking at 500 residents that could be using that. I'll let that number sink in. If you then went clear to Highway 9, you have a lot more. up the hill on Reed Street, more houses. So I encourage you that it is a perfect location and will probably be the most used park here in Cedar Woolley. So I encourage you to move forward for the safety of kids. I know you like safety, and you have to weigh the safety against the monetary value that you have to weigh. And it's a tough decision, but we're hoping that you'll share that decision, move forward with the park. Again, thank you for the time of coming and sharing. I did put out, and hopefully I didn't overstep my bounds, Aaron graciously gave me a map of the proposed park, and I put your consoles on the back of it, so that's why you're getting calls and emails. But thank you for your time, and hope to move forward with the park.
Thank you. And we did receive your petitions.
So maybe before the next person, if I could just offer a clarification. So there's no decisions have been made, but the history of this property, I think, might answer your question. The city purchased this for a pretty little amount of money during the recession as a storm drainage facility. So our stormwater utility owns it. The city went in, cleared the ditch, addressed stormwater in the vicinity. And in an effort to aid the council in future decision-making, we did contract with a landscape designer, and that's the plan that I gave you a copy of when you visited City Hall, of a concept park. So, you know, where we're at today is we've got a stormwater utility-owned piece of land. We've got a concept park that the council hasn't really looked at in any detail, and a proposal from Habitat for Humanity to purchase the land and build houses. So that's the lay of the land today, and really the process is at some point the city council will have to make a decision about the future of the site. If they did choose to develop it into a park, it is in our comprehensive plan, but we don't have any budget capacity or capital facility planning for that. So there's still some time lag on that front as well. So it's I guess I just want to make it clear, you know, this is infancy. We've done a lot of work, so there's information available, but it hasn't really made it to the policy decision level yet, and that's yet to come.
Is there anybody else for public comment?
Good evening. My name is Jed Holmes, 7691 Delvin Hill Road, Cedar Woolley. I'm here on behalf of the Skagit Conservation District. I'm not sure if you have seen either. I know, Madam Mayor, you received a letter about our proposal to introduce a small fee to help support fund the Conservation District's work. I'm here mainly for questions. The fee involved is $5 per parcel and 10 cents per acre. For a household, that's about 50 cents a month. And we hope countywide that will bring in approximately $300,000 for our work. I'd like to know if I brought some information so you can see where we propose to put that money and how it will help increase our services that are being offered to citizens and municipalities.
Jeff, what do you guys do at the Skagit Conservation District, especially in the way of riverbanks and rivers?
A lot of our work is focused, well, the Conservation District works as an agency. It's largely a pass-through in which it provides expertise that helps connect a lot of money either on the federal or the state level to put conservation on the ground. A lot of this is for clean waters in cities. It's rain gardens, parks, riverside, riverbank, creek improvements, getting native plants out there. Basically improving the habitat either for fish, for general water quality. That's just some. There's a lot you can see. Skagitcd.org is where you can see a large list of what we do. Conservation districts came out of organizations aimed at helping farmers, but of course right now it's much larger than that.
Okay. So this is actually public comment. It's not a Q&A, but it looks like you have information there.
Yeah.
Would you like to pass that out? We'd be willing to take that. And is there a contact number on there that we can reach you at?
You could reach us at skagit@skagitcd.org.
Okay.
So, all right. I'll
all right.
Give this to them.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Anyone else? Okay, then I will close public comment at 7:45, and we will move on to our public hearing. But first, let's do the 2019 property taxes. Doug, is that you? Are you up? Okay.
Jed, I think we're short one if you got one.
Pardon me?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just yelling at Jed, asking if he... Do you have another one?
Okay, thank you, City Council and Mayor. Tonight we have scheduled a first read and public hearing on the 2019 property tax levy. And I have a PowerPoint. I'll run us through for a few minutes here and then be able to answer any questions you might have. I'll still get used to this yet, aiming over there and looking over here. So tonight's goals, as I mentioned, it's a first reading and our public hearing. We want to discuss the 2019 property tax levy. There's a couple different things that we have that are involved in this. You've probably talked about these before, but the implicit price deflator is a piece of that. It's called the IPD. You'll hear me say that term. We'll talk a little bit about inflation measures and how that impacts the city's budget. We'll review some of the levy options for 2019. In your packets, there's a family of ordinances that we get to choose from doors number one to doors number four. And then a couple points I wanted to make. One, the perspective of the discussions tonight. I come and talk to you in terms of the organization. Property taxes can be kind of a hot topic every year when you bring these up. My job as finance director is to come to you and talk about the organization and how this interplays with our budget. So when I talk about these things, it's an organizational perspective to it. There'll come a time at our next public hearing where we get more into the policy matters, because we want to talk about not just the technical side of what we do at the city, but we have politics, we have socioeconomic things we want to discuss. Those will come up at that next meeting. But tonight, remember, as I'm talking about these, it's looking at the city organization and how property taxes affect us. And then I highlighted a point at the bottom. I mentioned just a few moments ago that we're working on the preliminary budget to have that done by November 1st. And just to let you and everyone know, in the preliminary budget, the mayor's directed, we do not have an increase shown in our property tax levy. At this time, we're going at a zero increase. So the annual review, we have to talk about the implicit price deflator. It's an economic term that means what's inflation doing. There are a couple different measures that are out there. You hear about the consumer price index. There's a lot of different ones that are put out there, but the one we are required under state law to look at is the IPD, the implicit price deflator. And the rules under RCW 84.55 say that each year when we look at this, property taxes, the annual cost of living adjustment, has to be the lesser of 1% or the change in that IPD. So that just sets the stage for what we have to look at. This year, we're going to be looking at where 1% is the maximum because the IPD is greater. And I've been asked already a couple times, what in the world is the IPD and what does it measure? Well, the Bureau of, I think it's, what is it, BEA, the Bureau of Economic Analysis is a federal organization. They look at different areas at what consumers buy. They monitor prices and see how prices are changing over time. So you hear like the Consumer Price Index, it's the same thing. There are a couple different ones there that measure different things. The IPD is its own, and it was referenced back in the Tim Eymann days when we had the different items coming forward and the legislature put this into state statute. So I have a slide that just shows the history of the IPD. It has been up and down for many years. I've got it from 1998 to 2018. As you can see, it's usually always grown. There's one odd year. It was right at the start of the recession in 2009 where it was actually negative. Prices were actually declining during the recession. Over that 20-year or so period, the average has been a little over 1.7%. Has been what prices have gone up over time. Why that's important to us is inflation is not our friend in city government a lot of times. This graph, what I wanted to do is show you what the typical measures of inflation are. You can see on the graph, the very top one is called the Seattle Area CPIU. That's the Consumer Price Index, and I believe it's urban purchases. It's a U stands for urban in there. Since 2002, inflation has gone up 48.05%. And for the statistics geeks like me, that includes compounding each year as it goes along. The next line down is the implicit price deflator, or IPD. That's a little bit different measure. It's a little bit less than the CPI. You can see, but over 20 years, it's gone up 34.82%, a pretty significant increase as well. Per state law, though, when cities look at your property tax, you don't just follow that index and match your property tax to it. There's a 1% ceiling on it. So what I thought might be helpful is the third line down, the orange one. I call it the IPD maximum. And that is, if it was at 1% every year, where would that top out at? And you can see that comes to about 18.43%. And then finally, the bottom line, the green line, is the history of Cedral Woolley's property tax levy history. As you can see, there's been five different years since 2002 where the property tax levy was increased by 1%. There's a little bit of compounding in there. You can see that extra 0.10. But that shows you kind of what our property tax levy has done when compared to inflation on a couple of different measures like that. So what does that mean when we talk about these indices and inflation and all that? We talk about purchasing power, and over time, we lose purchasing power if we don't keep up with inflation. Just like in our own home budgets and everything, we see prices go up, and we hope our incomes are able to do the same thing. Everybody, including cities, are in that same boat. But what I was able to do is to calculate what our purchasing loss has been over time since 2002. And if we just looked at the CPI, what a dollar would purchase and everything back then, if we were to have our property taxes follow that, we would have $817,000 more dollars a year to use in the general fund for city services than we do today. If you look at just the IPD, that number's over $500,000. If you look at the IPD maximum, just if we had been limited by state law and what property taxes can do, that number is about $250,000 more that we would have today for city services. So that is the loss of purchasing power over time that we experience when revenues and expenditure growth rates aren't the same. So some of the growth factors that impact our budget here at Cedral Woolley, it's the infamous tortoise and the hare slide. And what this really shows, I know there's a laser on here, but I'm afraid I'm going to lose my PowerPoint if I try to find it. Is it the big button? There it is. Okay. So as you can see, typically in a city government, expenditures grow anywhere 4 to 5%. It's inflation, and then you have some dynamics with city government where a lot of our money we put out is for staff time and things in-house. So things like medical insurance and those that grow at 7 to 9% a year, things like that really drive our expense ratios up. At the same time, we have a lot of revenues that are based on the economy and different things. We have different ways that we can set our revenues and make choices on those. So our revenues typically grow about 1.2 to 2.5%. Just about every city is in the same boat, has those very same ones. So what you get into each year is where you see those two lines grow apart, we're constantly trying to pinch those back together because of that rate differential like that. So in a way, it is a self method that basically shrinks your budget. It's a mathematical certainty that it's difficult to keep your budget balanced over time. So that puts the onus on us to be creative on what we're doing from a budget standpoint and also as a community on economic development. Those are key things for us. So this is just the same slide a little bit. I think I pretty much just explained this. But you can see what the true measures of inflation are. And why is it needed? It's like I said, inflation is not our friend. We don't have a lot of new services we're putting on the table and say we want to go out and spend for these new things. We're just trying to keep pace with what we're doing today. So we call it a level of service. It's the amount of work that we're doing. It's the number of police officers on the street. It's the number of miles of asphalt we're paving. Hopefully it's in terms of miles. Those things like that. So that's called a level of service, and we want to keep that the same. But our struggle is keeping the revenues to keep it the same. So the general fund revenue issues that I see as I'm preparing this preliminary budget, it's not all doom and gloom, but there are things that we have to be aware of. We have mild retail sales tax growth. Spit that one out three times. But it's running about 2%. There used to be years and years it was going 3 to 3.5%. The recession, there were a lot of minus signs in front of that number. Today we're running about 2%, and that's good. That's good. Some things that are a little bit more difficult is the state for a while was doing what was called streamlined sales tax mitigation. They had changed some sales tax laws, and then were trying to mitigate or soften the impact on different communities. That went for a period of time, but that has now expired and run out, so that we lost about $21,000 a year just through that action of the state. The other thing we're seeing is telephone utility tax. That's one of our revenues, is decreasing. And Aaron and I were talking about this one the other day. Some of the rules changed on this. When everybody went from the dial-up phones going to cell phones, there's changes there. And one is, I believe it's the data part of your cell phone package is not subject to utility tax, even though the calling part is. But what that's doing is things are shifting from landlines to cell phones. The pricing's different. Those things are different. And it's decreasing our revenue stream. Other areas that we're trying to put a lot of emphasis into our parks, our cemetery, and our street fund. You know, we're talking about State Street, and we're talking about other streets that we're paving and doing these things. The cost of commodities for asphalt, steel, concrete, those things, they're not our friends either on pricing when those goes up. So those are all pressures that I'm seeing right now. I think we're very close. We just have a little bit left to do in the general fund. But we're getting really close in having the budget balanced. So that's been a lot of hard work on everybody's part. So this is the next part. It gets a little bit into graphs, but I've talked to different people and some of the council members about this one. It's the compounding effect of property tax levies. If I were to just throw numbers up here, even I would fall asleep watching it. It can be pretty onerous going through all the numbers and everything, how it works. But what I want to do is talk about property taxes and how they work, because there are a lot of questions that I get and you will get as council members from your constituents that you have to kind of have an understanding a little bit beyond just paying it like we do out of our homes on how it works for a city. So I've put together a series of slides that talks about it, and hopefully that will help illustrate what we look at from an organizational perspective. So in this slide, I show year one is this green baseline across here, and I just picked $1 million. And say we're a city that has a property tax base of $1 million. And as we're moving through time, inflation visits us each year, and that line is typically going up. So what we're trying to do, remember, we're trying to keep pace with inflation to keep our level of service the same. So when we come to the first year and we're looking at, do we want to do a property tax levy of 1%, an increase, remember it's not just for this year, but that's a layer of property tax that goes into each year into the future. You have to think of that layering effect of that. Many times I get a question like, well, you know that 1%'s not very much money. Why don't you guys go and sharpen your pencils and find paper clips and things to keep that down? But you have to do that the first year, and they have to do the same amount plus the second layer, the next year. That layer keeps compounding each time. So you can see we went from $1 million here in year two, we're at $1,000,010. Now we're at $1,020,000. And each year as we go, these are all layers. You have to remember that layer perspective of this. It's not just a one-year snapshot. So as you get out here, we've gone out, what, about 5 years? You can see right in here, and we're at about the 1,050,000 mark. So what happens if you forego an increase, if you pass on this? We've talked about inflation a little bit. Typically what we can do is look at finding things to cut. Because those costs still go up, we have to find a similar amount to bring down. So many times a city will look at, okay, what do we have? And I put some pictures up there, you know, a lawnmower, file cabinet, a car. Maybe there's some things we can do to cut out to keep us balanced. But each year you do that, you start eroding away your ability to do that level of service because you're losing your equipment or people or different things like that. And you still will not meet inflation. You're doing one-time items. The other thing you can do is look at your reserves. I've seen cities do this where the reserve levels were stopped dropping down, and a reserve is extra cash you have on hand at the start of the year. As you look at their budgets over time, you see that number getting smaller and smaller. It's because they've gone to their reserves to try to keep up with that until they can think of a plan or put something in place. But as you do that, that reserve will keep getting smaller. That'll drain reserves, and you still, again, you don't meet inflation. So really the only thing you can do when you think of the long term and how we're trying to pinch those lines together going into the future is you have to talk in terms of things that are recurring. So that property tax, that layer, each time you do that, it's there for every year in the future. For us to be able to meet that, we have to either implement a new form of revenue that's recurring to balance it each year into the future, or you have to eliminate an expense that's recurring as well. It can't just be paper clips or paper. Typically what that means is you'll see your staff levels go down because the elimination of a position is a recurring expense. So unfortunately you get into that when you start looking around and seeing staffing levels are down and there's stress in your organization because they're bringing in more and more work, it's a symptom of this occurring. So again, we talked about this slide a little bit. So what we're really talking about is trying to keep that growth gap as small as we can. So which city operations are funded by property tax? It's not utilities. It's not some other things that we do. I put together a pie chart that just shows where we send our money. Starting at the right, our parks fund gets about 26% of our property tax. Cemetery fund, a little under 5%. Streets gets about 17%. That actually gets directly transferred right to the street fund. Public safety, which I've put together police, fire, and our court together as the public safety area, that gets about 37%. And then legal, finance, planning, other general fund functions, they make up about the remaining 14%.
None of that goes to schools?
No. No, this is just the amount of money that comes. The state collects money, and that goes to the state, and they send that to the schools, but it doesn't come through the city organization. Okay. That's a good question. So I picked one person in this room's property tax bill and put it up here because I wanted to point out that when you get a property tax bill from the county, not all of it is the city. So actually the big majority of it is going somewhere else. So as you can see in this case, Skagit County, Conservation Futures, different hospital and port districts, and there's your state and school levy that you're mentioning there. Those are all big pieces. I highlighted this in yellow so you can see that Cedral Woolley is about 18.5% of your property tax bill. So when you pay that every year to the county, that's a percent that comes to the city. So I put this in the visual term. So here's a dollar bill. So for every dollar, basically, that you pay to the county, 19 cents of it stays with the city. 81 cents goes to the county, state, or schools. So when we, that's a good point. 1% of that, when we talk about a 1% levy increase, it's not 1% of everyone's entire property taxes. It's only on that 19-cent piece. It's only on the city's component of that. So what is the fact? This is always the big question. So I took the city's levy rate that the county's given us, and I picked three different pricings. So I have an example here is what is the effect of 1% on a house that's $180,000, one that's $225,000, and one that's $400,000. So we can pick these. The city property tax, just the city portion of it on each of these homes, for the $180,000 house, it's $380. For the next one, it's $475. For the $400,000 house, the city piece is about $844. The per year increase, when you take the levy rate and divide that into it, is about $3.80. The 1% effect on a house at 180,000 years, $3.80 a year, $475 for this house, $8.45 for that house. And going one step further, the monthly increase is in cents. So 1% increase are 32 cents, 40 cents, and 70 cents, respectively. So getting to what you have in your packets, I referenced each ordinance, and hopefully my page numbers line up with your packet. So I have four doors for us to choose from when we talk about property tax levy. Door number one is we can select a property tax levy of zero increase. There's no increase in the property tax levy, no increase of the revenue into the city, and that's on page 60. That ordinance is in your packet. The second option we have is select a property tax increase of 1%. What that would bring into the city is about $19,258. The third option we have is you can select a property tax levy of zero, and we have what's called unbanking excess unused capacity. That's a mouthful to say. But basically, we have at the county about $67,000 in property taxes that's been banked away that wasn't used in past years. And then fourth, the final one, you can combine two and three together. You could do a 1% increase and unbank that unused capacity. That would raise about $86,000 for the city. So those are the four options. We're not looking at deciding that tonight. Remember, this is the first reading, and we're holding the public hearing on it. So we'll do those items there. But really, this is for us to discuss options, or if there's any additional information I can give to you. Again, I want to make a note that in the budget, we have not increased property taxes. So right now, we're showing it zero. We're looking to balance the budget with a zero increase on that. So that is my presentation. Again, remember, we have a public hearing to hold tonight, and I can answer any questions you might have.
It was a great presentation. Thank you.
Yes. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Can you explain a little more about the unbanking, the unused capacity? That's mm-hmm. a little bit unclear to me.
Yeah, it's kind of an odd piece that's out there. So what you have is each year there's the highest lawful amount of property taxes the city can take in and tell the county this is what we want you to collect. If in past years you did a 0% increase, they don't actually raise your money up, what you're going to get, but that highest lawful levy measure that they use still goes up by the 1%. So what that does is there's a gap. If you didn't take it, it goes in the bank. So that 1% accumulates a little bit over time, and a future council from that time of that decision can come back and say, we see a need, we have, and we want to unbank that. We now want to pull that in and have the county start collecting that.
Okay. Is there any downfall?
No.
Penalty?
There's no penalty or anything like that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So one clarification question on that. So is that what's been banked over the last, is it 11 years that we haven't done a property tax increase?
That's probably where the majority of it is. There okay. have been times, I believe, I've heard that city councils made specific steps to not bank in some of those years. And there's a methodology where you can do that. And in some years, it was banked. but it was basically over that 11-year period.
Well, Doug, I appreciate the information. I think it's disheartening to look back at, you know, 11 years of no increase, and I'm not one that would normally support property tax increase, but we have a level of service and an obligation to this community, and I think people have grown accustomed to the level of service that we provide, and I think we're going to start seeing a decline in service if we don't make these critical decisions, such as a property tax increase.
That was a pretty slick presentation you put on there, Doug. You're talking about keeping up with inflation. I know the city needs to keep up with inflation, but there's people out there on Social Security, they don't keep up with inflation. They get, I think, some people I talked to got $1 a month raise. They give you 1.5. I think this year it's going to be 2 point something, but then they'll probably raise Medicare, take every bit of it. You might end up with $2 or $3. But I know that 1% sounds like nothing, but to a lot of people it's a lot. Every dollar comes out of their budget, comes probably out of their grocery bill. And I'll be honest with you, I've talked to people that's very close to having to sell their home just to survive. So it concerns me. There's got to be ways besides raising property tax to balance a budget. It sounds good if you're making 70 to 120, 30,000 a year, that's nothing. But somebody that's making 19, 20, 22,000 a year, that's a lot. So it won't hurt me that much. But I'm thinking about the people out there that's talked to me about it. It hurts them a lot. And I'm sorry, I have a soft heart for people that are struggling, and people that elected me to this office, and some people that's not even in my ward, but I still listen to them, and I have compassion for them. Well, I'm not for the property tax. If the budget can be balanced without it, great. It would be nice to have extra money, but then we're going to have to tighten our purse strings too, quit spending so much money. A lot of things that we can get by without. But I enjoyed your presentation. It was very good and very accurate. It didn't change my mind.
True.
I was just going to say, I think we just need, there's just certain things we're just going to need as our city grows. And I'm not, of course, not in favor of an increase, but at the same time, we really just have to get ahead of this because we don't want things to deteriorate on our watch either. And I will say that for folks with limited income, I would say that I probably could qualify for that myself. And I will say that there are ways to get around that with the city. I was just talking about that earlier today. We probably should just make that more well known. I don't think a lot of people know that if you have a limited income, then you can get, you know, a portion of that kind of taken care of. And I'm not sure how easy that is for people to know. I'm just thinking that maybe there could be something more on our website, or make it more streamlined for people who might need a little help or a little assistance.
Yeah, well, we could certainly put more information out there. It's low income, senior, and or disabled. Mm-hmm. So you have to be both low income senior or low income disabled, qualify for the property tax reduction through the county, then you also get the utility tax reduction through the city. And our utility billing clerk will also on her own do just some general auditing of bills. You know, if she sees somebody seems to be struggling, she'll look it up and see if they've got the property tax discount, and if they do, she'll notify them that they're eligible for the utility rate reduction as well. So we do try to get that information out there.
Yeah, if we could like make it easy for people to access that without stigmatizing themselves, and you know, if there was a way to figure out that, then that would be great too.
I think we discussed that a little bit. Yeah. One of the things I have observed is we could advertise that, even a flyer with the utility bills, just a reminder, yep, if you're in this position. Just having spoken with people over the years, too, what I notice, and I think you and I talked about this a little bit, sometimes when people are having a hard time, it's difficult for them personally to come in and ask. Mm-hmm. It's a point of pride a little bit, or they want to feel like they're carrying their weight as a person in the community. And sometimes it's amazing how much you almost have to twist their arms and let them know it's okay to apply, and we can help you out and do that. So it's one of those things. One is letting people know it's out there, and then doing it in such a way where it's gentle and they know, hey, this is okay. We're here to help you out. So.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Anyone else? So at this point, I will open up by looking for individuals. If you'd like to give testimony, you can come forward, give your name and address. If you'd like to talk about property taxes or your opinion of them, this is your opportunity. Okay. So I will actually close this then, the property tax, and open up the utility tax.
Okay, so the next item on the agenda are the three utility rate ordinances. This is just like the property tax. It's a first reading and public hearing. I don't have an exciting PowerPoint for you, but we've largely discussed most of these already. The big increases are in the solid waste utility, and their primary drivers there are the cost of recycling, which the council's already voted on, and the tipping fee increases from Skagit County, which is a cost outside of our control. So in these three ordinances, you see across the board a 3.3% increase, which is reflective of the CPI for Seattle, Tacoma, Bellevue, the new closest regional measure of inflation. And then for the solid waste utility, the combination of the recycling rate increase and the garbage tipping fees adds about 9.36% in additional rate. And then there's a final two components that are spread across the three utilities. One is a portion of a planned additional IT specialist position. This will be a second FTE for IT, information technology, here at the city. And that position would be allocated based upon our current allocation model, which uses network-attached devices as a measure of how they're charged across the city. So that position has a little bit of revenue from each of the three utilities and the majority of it from the general fund. And then the last piece is on the public works facility, which the city council I felt had clearly indicated in conversations was a priority item. This facility would be designed to accommodate all of our vehicles, including the trash trucks that are currently parked outside. It would include a mechanics, you know, fleet bay, so the mechanics no longer working in the gravel or out of doors. It's about a 15,000 square foot building, and it's expensive. You know, I think when we first dreamed it up, many years ago, we thought maybe it was $1 million, and more recently it seemed like $2 million, and we've got more accurate estimates now in the $4 million range. So the mayor is going to propose a three-phase approach to addressing this problem. Phase one in 2019 is utility rate increases to support design phase work. Our hope is that by having a full design, we could get better cost estimates, potentially seeing a number that's lower than $4 million. Phase two would be additional rate increases in the general tax contribution. So at the end of phase two would be generating enough revenue to support annual debt service payments for a 20-year note to construct this facility, which is what would occur in phase three. So that's the difference in rate between the 3.3% and the bottom line. So for example, in sewer, there's a 0.66%. and that .66 represents sewer's contribution to the building and sewer's contribution to IT positioning. Same thing with stormwater. There's a 4.08% increase. That represents a little bit of IT, a really little bit for IT. There's not much technology in that department. And, well, I should say there's not much network-attached technology in that department. And then the rest of it's really for the building. Stormwater has quite a bit of equipment. And then solid waste is just the big giant in this. They represent about 48% of the new building. So there's a significant portion of that rate represents the building and a smaller portion for IT. But the biggest piece of theirs, more than half, is just tipping fee and recycling disposal costs to continue that work. And then one quick note on the solid waste and recycling. The council had asked in the fall, well, it seems like fall, it might have been summer, time goes by, the council seemed to be pretty ready to hire a position for the solid waste department. The mayor's balanced budget that comes out next week does not include a rate increase to support a position. However, we believe that as a result of growth in that utility through additional customers and additional tonnage coming through our commercial hauling primarily, that those rates can support the position. So her budget will include a new FTE for the solid waste department, a new driver, somebody that we bring on board in the springtime. So just want to make that note. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, just like the property tax. This is a public hearing tonight to hear from the community. It's first reading. And next time you'll see it after tonight will be on November 14th, when you'll also have already heard in detail the mayor's balanced budget proposal. And then you'll have your first reading on the budget on the 14th as well. Are there any questions?
I guess I do have a question. I don't quite understand, you know, Leo is going to need this position, you know, and so new growth and all of this is going to fund that. How do we know, you know, do you expect a certain amount of new growth or...
Yeah, so that's a fair question. It's not just pie in the sky. What we're seeing is that our 2018 actual to budget is the revenues are exceeding what we budgeted in certain areas. So just for example, in our large roll-off container business, we have about $90,000 more this year than we budgeted. Now that business is fairly cyclical, so we wouldn't want to count on that as a recurring cost, as a recurring revenue to support a recurring cost. But we also know that in the 2019 budget that you'll see, there are a number of one-time items that we don't anticipate would be recurring. And so it's a combination of comfort that there will be increased rate revenue that exceeded our budgetary expectations this year, with some one-time expenditures that would go away in 2020, gives us comfort that that position could be funded. And there's no question about the need. That department is just really stretched thin at their current level of service. So that's where that came from.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know, Aaron, from my experience working down there, that Leo's needed another man for a long time. He doesn't have, if somebody calls in sick, you know, he's in a bind. And he's having to spend a lot of time on a garbage truck when he should be in the office, you know. People from time to time need to talk to him. So I'm in total agreement with that, because that's been overdue for a long time. I'm glad to hear that another structure is going to be constructed there too. That's way overdue. So that's great. So yeah, I'd like to make it stressful for Leo, but I have to feel sympathy for him. He does need somebody. Thank you.
And I'll let him know you're dead set against it.
Aaron, I've got a couple questions. One thought on the IT specialist is, have we ever looked at contracting out support for that department, because I would, you know, venture a guess to say that we could probably gather contract services at a cheaper price than bringing on another FTE.
Yeah, so we actually did contract with IT until we internalized that function by hiring Bill back in maybe around 07, 08. And I honestly can't imagine ever going back that direction, given the total difference in the level of service we have through an internal, you know, provision of that work. The problem that Bill has is to have an outside contractor with the same level of knowledge to be able to jump in if there's a network emergency is difficult. We really need, because we've talked about that as an interim, you know, could we get some backup from somebody who'd be available to troubleshoot? But the troubleshoot calls are such that you really have to understand the network architecture and be able to jump in and work on it. So our solution has been, you know, Bill takes his device wherever he goes. So we've got a little more flexibility with his work arrangement, as long as he's willing to work flexibly wherever he is. So that's worked okay, but he does remote in from out of state and out of country. You know, even South America last year when he was traveling, he was able to jump in and troubleshoot for us. So I think we're beyond the point where that would work. I think we actually do need the staff support, and more importantly, having somebody who's really immersed in our network architecture and can jump in to fill that gap if we have one, I think is important. We are doing our best to offload cloud-type services, so Bill's done a great job of moving us away from city server maintained data to cloud data, which reduces his workload.
Is it a workload reduction that we could look at with a part-time position for a year? Or
we talked about that too. The concern with a part-time position is that we don't think we could attract somebody at the level that we need only working part-time.
Right. And then I guess my last point would be on the public works facility. I think I mentioned this in conversation, but would like, you know, the whole council to be aware. I'd like us to look at what existing commercial properties are in the city that we could possibly acquire or could meet our needs without, you know, new construction at the same site, because I don't think it's absolutely vital to any of the operation that if solid waste moved, you know, it would leave future growth for the sewer plant. And, you know, is there commercial property available within the city that we could, you know, possibly acquire and save ourselves a couple million?
Yeah, no, I think we would be happy to look for any potential, you know, probably early in the design phase. So if we happen to find it, we're not wasting money on designing a building we wouldn't build.
How's the maple leaves coming?
They're thick.
I can't even see your white car in the morning.
So if there's no more questions, I will open it up to the public. If you'd like to give testimony regarding the utility taxes, please state your name, address. Keep it to 3 minutes. Is there anyone? Okay. Well, I will close this public hearing then. And we will move on to unfinished business. So, John?
Thank you. Okay, so at the last city council meeting, I gave about a 15-minute presentation on the Planning Commission's work on the planned residential development updates. I'd prefer not to do that again, unless your City Council would like me to rehash that. Otherwise, I'll just open it up to any questions after the Council's had some time to review it further.
John, I had questions last time, and the sticking point for me is I'm on board with higher standards, but I don't like the fact that that we're allowing for smaller lot sizes in order to gain, you know, more open space. I don't find it appealing, and I don't think it fits Cedar Woolley to have smaller lot sizes. You know, I don't think, you know, for something as, you know, small lot sizes as along the lines of like Wildflower, you know, looking at newer developments, I don't really want to see anything smaller than what we have like in, you know, Klinger or Spring Lane in those areas. I think that's an appropriate lot size for the city. And I don't think by cramming houses together to gain a little bit of open space fits this town.
So Klinger was a planned residential development, and that was one that the Planning Commission felt was a successful planned residential development. Our current zoning code would not, and subdivision regulations would not allow for Klinger to be built today. So this ordinance is designed to allow specifically that type of development. Wildflower, I don't believe would be allowed. I don't think lots that small would be allowed. I forget off the top of my head, but I want to say some of those are in the 2,500 square foot range. The minimum lot sizes in the R5 zone, for example, is 4,800 square feet in size would be the smallest that would be allowed. In the R7 zone, no lot shall be less than 4,800 square foot in size, except 50% may be as small as 4,000 square feet. So throughout Klinger, some of this, there are some lots in the high 3,000s, like 3,600, 3,700 square foot. So this actually would be fairly in line with Klinger. And except for, of course, you know, the townhouse lots, which are allowed to be down to 2,500 square feet. But, you know, that's a different sort of thing. And you can see those examples in Klinger. Those are actually a little smaller. I think the smallest one there is 1,900 square feet. But again, we're trying to, you know, the Planning Commission was trying to improve on our previous PRD regulations. And then, of course, there is a provision that right now in the R5 zone, 8,400 square foot is the smallest lot size. Now, you can go down to 4,800 square feet according to this ordinance, but when you do the average of all of the properties in all of the new lots in that development, except for, we'll take townhouses out of that, so all the single-family lots will say can only be a 20% average less than 8,400 square feet. So therefore, the average single-family lot size would be 6,700. The number's right here. There's 6,720 square feet would be the average of the minimum lot size for single-family houses in the R5. It's a little lower in the R7 zone. That number gets down to 4,800 square feet. So the average has to be 4,800 square feet for single-family homes.
Why are we allowing for, or I guess is the sole thinking behind that, allowing for the 20% to create more open space?
And to allow different types of lots to be developed instead of it. It seems like it's very practical to say, you know, minimum lot size of 6,000 square feet, and that works in many cases. But when a developer is looking at the specific site, you look at the, you know, where roads have to go, the terrain, and the size, the shape of the lot to begin with, you know, it makes designing the development a lot easier when you have a flexibility to do some smaller, some bigger, instead of just all 6,000.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Is council ready to move on this, or would you like to wait till the next meeting? Okay, no interest. We will wait until the next meeting. And with that, we will move into executive session. This will be for RCW 42.30.110. One I. And this has to do with litigation. There's no action requested tonight. So, all right.